From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the man behind the cameras on Taxi, Cheers, Frasier, and Will and Grace, TV director and producer James Burrows, is being honored Saturday with a career tribute at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, which is sponsored by HBO. Burrows got his start directing episodes of The Mary Tyler Moore Show and The Bob Newhart Show. We'll talk with him about his long career in television. Also, music critic Milo Miles remembers guitarist and singer Ali Farkature of Mali, who died this week from bone cancer at the age of 66. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Taxi, Cheers, Frasier, and Will and Grace have something in common, James Burrows. He's played a key role in each of them. He will be honored with a career tribute this Saturday at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen, which is sponsored by HBO. Burrows has earned 10 Emmys and 4 Directors Guild Awards. He got his start directing MTM productions like The Mary Tyler Moore Show and The Bob Newhart Show. From there, he became the resident director of Taxi. Then he co-founded the production company that created Cheers and directed the pilot and many of the subsequent episodes. Here's one of his scenes from episode 3 of Cheers with Ted Danson and Shelley Long.
Why are you so upset?
You know, this week, I have gone out with all the women I know. I mean, all the women I really enjoyed. And all of a sudden, all I can think about is how stupid they are. I mean, my life isn't fun anymore. And it's because of you.
Because of me?
Yeah. You're a snob.
A snob?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, you're a rapidly aging adolescent.
Well, I would rather be that than a snob.
And I would rather be a snob.
Well, good, because you are.
Sam, do yourself a favor. Go back to your tootsies and your rat parts. I'd hate to see the bowling alleys close on my account.
Hey, wait a minute. Are you saying that I'm too dumb to date smart women?
I'm saying that it would be very difficult for you. A really intelligent woman would see your line of BS a mile away.
You think so, huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, you know, I've never met an intelligent woman that I'd want to date.
On behalf of the intelligent women around the world, may I just say...
After Cheers ended and the character of Frasier got his own series, Burrows directed the pilot and many episodes. He's directed Will and Grace for the past 8 seasons. Even Burrows' family resume is impressive. His father, Abe Burrows, wrote the books for the musicals Guys and Dolls, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and Cactus Flower. At the very start of James Burrows' career, he worked on some of his father's musicals.
I was an assistant stage manager, or an assistant to the assistant, on an ill-fated musical called Breakfast at Tiffany's, where I met Mary Tyler Moore and Richard Chamberlain were the stars. And I went on subsequently to stage manage for my father on Cactus Flower, the production on the road, and then in New York City in 40 Carats. So I got to see my father, who really wrote on his feet, because he would write a scene and then when he would get in rehearsal, he would change the scene just on his feet. And you began to see how fascinating he was. And that's when I kind of have his style of directing. I'm a listener. I'm not necessarily a watcher. And Abe would always, he would say to me when he went to a run through of one of his shows or went to see one of his shows in the theater, he would always walk behind the set. He wouldn't watch because he wanted to know that there was always noise happening on stage. He listened for the noise. He knew if there was no noise that he was in trouble. So I do that when I direct my shows. So that, you know, that is the essence of the experience with my father. In subsequent years, a lot of his gift and a lot of his skills seemed to come out of me at the strangest times. It's not like I learned them as much as, they were like osmosis. I absorbed them and they kind of seep out of my skin in certain situations.
So when you're directing a TV show, you're sometimes backstage and not looking at the action or at the monitor?
Well, I never look at the monitor because it's about, the shows I do are in front of a live audience, so it's about the play. It's about what's happening there. I've been doing it long enough to know that I don't have to worry about the camera shots because I know they'll all be there. So I listen and watch. You know, I'll walk behind the cameras, not watching the action necessarily. But a lot, you know, most of the time I watch the play and I make my writers watch the play, or they can watch the cut on the screen. But they don't watch the quad split. A quad split is a television screen that has the 4 cameras that I use to shoot the show on that. And if they watch the quad split, they're always worried about mics and shots not matching. So I make all the writers watch the play because that's eventually what makes a hit show.
So what made you realize that you wanted to switch from the stage to television?
In the course of doing Cactus Flowers and 40 Carats around the country, I would work at a lot of dinner theaters, a lot of dinner theaters, summer stock theaters. I would do these comedies, Odd Couple, Barefoot in the Park, even Blythe Spirit I did. I'm trying to say Never Too Late. All these plays, the comedies that have been in Broadway, and I do them with stars. And I had about 8 days to stage the whole thing, and I could get it done. I was good at that. And then one night I was at home after rehearsal, and I turned on the television, and there was the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And they were doing 20 minutes a week in front of a live audience. And here I was doing 120 minutes a week to get ready for a live audience. And I thought I could do that. I thought I could translate my skills on stage to the skills required to do that television show, because it was like filming a theatrical show. So I wrote a letter to Mary Tyler Moore. As I said before, I had the connection because I was a stage manager on her first Broadway show, so she kind of knew me. And Grant Tinker called me, and he said, we're interested in theatrical directors at MTM. Would you come out and do one show? And I don't know what's faster than the New York second, but whatever it was, I said yes. And the rest is history.
So you got started directing MTM productions like the Bob Newhart Show, Mary Tyler Moore Show, Phyllis, yes?
Yes. Yes.
Now, were you at first like understudying other directors, or did they let you just go at it?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to learn the technical stuff. So they brought me out here, and you kind of have to observe. Being an observer is you sit in the stands and you watch a week of rehearsals, and the first 3 days are with actors and writers alone, and the fourth day the cameras come in, and the fifth day you shoot the show. And for me, with actors and writers, I kind of got that. It was when the cameras came in that it became daunting. So I watched for maybe 2 months straight. I watched on the Newhart Show. Then I went over to the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and I watched Jay Sandrich, who to me is the true genius of this medium. I watched him and became very good friends with him. So I kind of started to get a knowledge of what to do with cameras, how to figure them out. And then they assigned me to a show called Friends and Lovers, which was the Paul Sand show. And I would coach. I was Paul Sand's dialogue coach. I would help him run lines. But in a time when I wasn't doing that, I would watch cameras. And eventually they called me and they said, we're going to give you a shot. And I figured it would be on the Paul Sand show. And all of a sudden it was a Mary Tyler Moore show.
Do you remember that first show that you did?
I do, vividly.
How did it go? What sticks out in your mind?
Oh, my God. Well, we read the script. It was a show where Lou Grant moves into Rhoda's apartment. So he's living above Mary, which means that they work together and they live together, which wasn't good for the relationship. And so we read the script around the table, and it was a D-. It was awful. And I said to Grant, I said, in a sea of Danish, I get a bagel. And it was literally, the show was awful. I mean, the initial reading, they made it better because the writers would rewrite all the time. And so I had to go down. Back in those days, you rehearsed immediately after you read. You just went down and started running scenes. And so I was dealing with a cast who hated the script too, and yet I had to run these scenes. And so I would do it, and I can't tell you, I invoked Chekhov, I invoked Strindberg, I invoked Kaufman and Hark. I did anything to try to ease it for them, to try to come up with some comic business, anything that would help them get through this process. And so I was working the first 3 days with the actors and cameras, and I guess we finally got the show in some sort of semblance, and then the cameras came in, and that was daunting enough for me. It was very difficult. I did it on my own. I didn't want any help. And on the fifth day, just before we shot, Mary Tyler Moore came over to me, and they said, we feel our investment in you has worked out. And that was even before I shot the show. And I couldn't have been higher, figuratively. And we shot the show, and it turned out all right. And Jay Sanders was there and helped me a little bit. And the minute that show was over, I got two new hearts, and I got a Bob Crane and a Paul Sand. And next year I was on the Phyllis show, so I was on my way.
Was the show as bad after it was shot as it was when you were doing the reading?
It was. It's a C-plus show. It's not a very good show. In fact, the script after me won an Emmy. So I, by the luck of the draw, I got. I didn't get the Emmy show. I got an okay show, and it might have helped me because of the amount of work I had to do and the amount of talking and inspiring I had to do might have, in hindsight, might have really helped me succeed in there and impress the actors.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Burrows, and he's probably the leading director of sitcoms on television. Some of the ones he's done include Taxi, Cheers, Frasier, Friends, Will and Grace. And the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival is about to give him a career tribute. Okay, so you start off at MTM in television, and then you do Taxi. And about how many episodes would you estimate you did of Taxi?
I think I did 75.
And you were there right from the beginning with Taxi, right?
I was there. It was after I kind of left MTM after about 3 or 4 years and started to go other places. I went on Laverne and Shirley, where I had a ball, although that was a tough show. And then I did a show with Ned Beatty. And I was all a hired hand. I didn't do many pilots or anything like that. And then the boys from MTM, Ed Weinberger, Jim Brooks, Stan Daniels, and Dave Davis had created a show called Taxi, and they called me to direct it. And probably the most difficult show I ever did because the cast was so divergent. The writing was so outrageous. The set was so gigantic. And it was my first really big show where I was in charge from the beginning. But it was like getting all these egos in the same room. There wasn't a room big enough. And it was a struggle. And yet I was heard. I got out there and I said what I wanted to say, and I was heard. It was tough at times to be heard, but I fought. And the great thing about that show was that the producers of that show and head writers were Glenn Charles and Les Charles, who I'd first met on Phyllis, and then they were brought in on Taxi. So we struck up a friendship. We were both handled by the same agent, and he thought it would be good for us to do a show together. So I think about the third year of Taxi, we started to think about a show. But the Taxi, if you go back and watch that show, there is some of the funniest television I think I've ever done. In the retrospective, I think they're going to show a clip package for at Aspen, and the standard out of that show is Reverend Jim, what does the yellow light mean? Slow down. And that is, to me, one of the biggest laughs I had ever done on Taxi. And so I have fond memories of that show. It was also a great learning experience.
My guest is TV director James Burrows. Here's the clip from Taxi, where Reverend Jim, played by Christopher Lloyd, is taking a written driver's license test. Some of his friends from the taxi company are with him.
Psst. What does a yellow light mean? Slow down. Okay. What? Yellow light mean? Slow down. Okay. What does a yellow light mean? Slow down.
Yeah. We'll talk more with director James Burrows after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Burrows. He's being honored with a career tribute Saturday at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen for his work directing such sitcoms as Taxi, Cheers, Frasier, and Will and Grace. When we left off, we were talking about Taxi. You mentioned the egos that were in the room when you were doing that show, and one of the actors was Andy Kaufman, who has to be one of the oddest personalities in comedy. What was it like to work with him? I mean, and did he know who he was? Because you always wonder about Andy Kaufman. Is he a collection of personas, or who's the real person there?
Andy Kaufman was a rich kid from Great Neck, Long Island. I met his parents. They're a very straight-laced couple from there. Andy was, to me, the smartest comedian I'd ever met. He knew exactly what he was doing at every time, at every moment. He also had the guts to be able to go on stage and do something until you laughed. He didn't care whether he didn't get laughs. He was going to commit to the material, and eventually you would laugh. He went out once, and I saw him read Gone with the Wind. He opened the book and started reading. And there's 2 minutes of silence until people start to get what the routine is. Any other comic would have fled. He was amazing. He was an amazing guy. He created that character of Foreign Man, which the boys saw and loved and put into Taxi. And he had a photographic memory. He had day-night reversal, which meant he would come in after lunch and rehearse his scenes. He wouldn't come in the morning. And, you know, there's on that show, what indelibly sticks in my mind is the episode with Tony Clifton, who was Andy Kaufman's alter ego.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who've seen the film, A Man in the Moon, they know what I'm talking about. But it was a marvelous day to be on the Taxi stage when Tony Clifton arrived.
Now, after Taxi, you left with a couple of the creators of Taxi, Glenn Charles and Les Charles, and started Cheers. And on Cheers and on Taxi, you had a chance to direct characters from the very start and therefore to help shape them through your direction, as opposed to inheriting characters on an already existing series. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to actually create a character from scratch, a character that you hope will endure for years in a series?
Well, the first thing that has to happen, it has to be on the page. So I'm very careful when I select scripts. And when we talked about, Glenn Les and I talked about doing Cheers, we spent 2 months talking about these characters. And then the boys went off and wrote the script. And a month later, when I read it, I said to the boys, you have brought radio back to television, which is what they did. They wrote a really smart show that literally could have been a radio show because there wasn't that much movement. It was all about attitudes and all about intonations and nuances and stuff like that. And
can I just stop you? That would be a terrible insult to a lot of people. If you said, there are a lot of TV people, if you said to them, you've just produced this brilliant radio show, you've just written a brilliant radio show, they would think that was a terrible insult because they're working on television. And sometimes when you say radio to television people, it's like saying you don't know what you're doing. You're blind. You can hear, but you're blind.
No. If you watch that show, people cross occasionally. Norm comes into the bar. But you got to listen to that show. It's all about listening.
Absolutely,
There's no eye candy in that show. There's no... I'll never forget, originally the boys in the first draft had some kind of hurdle race in there that we took out. But it was. They came in, they sat down, they told their stories, and that's what it is. You could have done that show on radio. You wouldn't have to worry about how the actors looked as long as their voices were good. But it was a television show. But when I meant brought radio to television, what it was smart. It was a smart show. It was an upscale, smart show with jokes about Schopenhauer and Updike and Freud and Jung, and we didn't care if the audience knew who those people were. And there was a genius job, and so it was my job to shape this cast. You cast them, you cast these people individually, but you don't know what you have until you put them together. So I always, in pilots, I always will begin by sitting around a big table. And in fact, on Cheers, we sat around the bar, and we talked about where everybody came from, their characters. You know, I carried a conversation on with Sam and Diane and Norm and Cliff and everybody like that, and we talked. And it's not only good for me, it's good for the actors, because they're going to want to talk anyway. And if I can do it now and get them to talk and get them, they'll only grow into the roles more. So we spent, you know, half a day just sitting around, probably a day sitting around talking, and then I went to work on it. And it was, you know, I did 240 out of like 275 shows. And I had a great time. I love that show. That's my baby. And I was there from the beginning for the cast, and I was there at the end, and they trusted me. And we after a while, we knew what worked and what didn't work. We didn't have to spend a lot of time on stuff that didn't work, and we could make the stuff work that worked really quickly.
James Burroughs will be back in the second half of the show. He's being honored with a career tribute Saturday at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, shooting in front of a live audience, we continue our conversation with TV director James Burroughs, whose credits include Taxi, Cheers, Frasier, and Will and Grace. Also, Milo Miles remembers Ali Farkature, the internationally known guitarist and singer from Mali. He died this week at the age of 66. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with TV director and producer James Burroughs. He's being honored with a career tribute Saturday at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen. He was the resident director of Taxi and directed the pilots and many episodes of Cheers and Frasier. He's directed Will and Grace for the past 8 seasons. Along the way, he's directed episodes of Friends, Veronica's Closet, Dharma and Greg, The Bob Newhart Show, and The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Cheers are shot in front of a live audience. Do the laughs help the actors? And does it ever work against the show? In other words, like, because the actors can't, like, pick up and say the next line until the laughs fade. And, of course, the audience at home isn't in the studio audience. So the timing, do you think the timing when you're watching at home is any different than the timing when you're in the theater?
Well, yeah. Laughter is communal, so it really helps to have an audience, because movies are so much better. I try to go see comedies in a theater rather than try to watch them at home in the movies, because it's really tough to laugh at home. Or I'll get the family in to watch, and then you can all laugh. But it's infectious and it's communal. So those were true laughs, and you can tell they're true laughs because you can see the actors' eyes glint on Cheers. You can see the glint in their eyes, the excitement and hearing such a big reaction to something they've said. And they had to wait to be heard. And sometimes they wouldn't wait and have to back up and say, you know, let's go back a little bit, and so they would be heard. But those are true laughs. That show was a truly funny show.
Okay, well, say you had to back up because they weren't heard, or say you want another take because it didn't work. What happens when the audience is hearing the joke the second time and their laughter is, it's not going to be the same the second time around? They've already heard the joke, they've already laughed at it.
But they've laughed at that joke, but then you go the second time so that you can get the reaction of the other person to that joke, and then you can hear the other line from the person because they have previously set it into a laugh and you didn't hear it. So that's why you have to do that. But you'll use the first take of that joke because the laughter was so big.
So do you ever use the laughter from one take and roll it for a second take?
So yeah, you use when you cross takes, you'll take the laughter from the first take and play it over the reaction in the second take.
Right, right.
So you have to do that. Otherwise, you couldn't make sense of the show or people saying lines into laughs. You have to hear every line. So we didn't do that a lot. Back in the Cheers days, we only ran the scene twice. I would back up occasionally if somebody said something to laugh, but we didn't run the scene twice like we do now. We ran the Cheers scenes only once, and then I would go back if we missed something or we wanted to change one joke. I would go back and just shoot a piece of the scene again. On Will and Grace, we do every scene twice, and in between each scene, the writers rewrite some jokes.
Really?
Yeah.
So the audience gets to see two different versions of the scene.
Yes. It, if you're going to do a scene twice, it really helps to change the jokes.
Now, is that typical that the writers are on the set? Typical for you,
oh,
maybe.
Yeah.
Is it typical for other shows?
Oh, yeah. Any sitcom, you got to see what... I mean, if you're not on the set, you don't know whether the show bombs or not. You got to be there to see. It's either euphoria or it's your funeral, but you got to be there, and you got to fix what doesn't work, because that's going on the air. You don't want something that's no good going on the air, so you better fix it.
No, Lisa Kudrow had this great series recently on HBO called The Comeback, in which she played somebody who'd been on a real popular sitcom and is now kind of washed up, and she has a small role on a new sitcom. And you play the director of that new sitcom.
Yeah, I did.
And there's one scene in there where she has like one line in the whole episode of the sitcom that she's shooting. And so she really wants it to be great and to have this big laugh, and she thinks like the laugh isn't big enough and she didn't say it quite right, so she wants to do it over. And she insists to you that she wants another take, and you tell her, no, it was fine, we're moving on. And she starts saying to the audience, I want another take, another take, another take. And she gets the audience to chant along with her. And then you take her backstage and give her a little lecture about how like that's really not good. You can't do that. The take was good enough, and she should figure out that she's not the star of the show.
I did say you took a small part and hit it out of the park. You're not it anymore. Yes, I did say that to her.
So did you ever have to – is there anything in real life that was ever like that scene where an actor said, no, I want to do it again. I could get a bigger laugh, and you had to say no?
No, that's egregious. I mean, I would really – I would take the actor behind the woodshed for that. That wasn't terrible. You know, even as an actor acting that part, it's incredibly emasculating and embarrassing. you know, for the sake of the show, since I do get a chance to read her the riot act at the end, it was okay. But I actors are more subtle than that, or the ones I work with are. They will come and say, I don't feel like I hit it, and I'll say, okay, we're going to do another take. If an actor, you don't want to just ride over an actor. They're people too. They have opinions. They're smart. They want to get it right. If they watch themselves, they want to know they're playing the right emotion, and it's not too difficult to go back. If it's handled correctly, if it's handled as a la Valerie Cherish handled it, it's not very good.
What are some of the inappropriate things that actors have done on the set? And you don't have to mention names.
Well, they always curse. If they forget a line, they always curse. And of course, that gets a big laugh. I remember doing the Tony Randall show back in the 70s, and Tony would go up and mistake just because he could say the F word in front of the audience, and it would loosen everybody up. But there have been instances where actors were on an unhappy show, not on a happy show. And I don't work usually on a happy show. Sometimes I get saddled with one, and then I don't like it very much, so I don't pursue those shows anymore. But I've seen actors so upset with writing that they'll dog a performance, which is amazing that an actor's vanity will let them dog a performance. But I've seen that.
I mean, they'll intentionally do it badly because they hate the writing so much?
Yeah.
That's kind of sabotaging themselves, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. But I've seen that occasionally. I try to stop that and stem the tide on that when I see it. But I don't usually get a lot of behavior. Sometimes I get actors going to their dressing rooms and they're pissed at something, and then, you know, you draw straws to see who has to go in there and spend some time with them and get them out of the dressing room, and, you know, you play that game. But as far in front of the audience, there are not, I don't see much egregious behavior.
No, as we mentioned, you usually work before a live audience, and so the laughter that you're using is real laughter. It's not canned laughter. But do you ever sweeten the real laughter with canned laughter?
Sometimes if you you're making an edit and you need to bridge the edit, sometimes you'll sweeten it a hair. But we do not. On Will and Grace, sometimes you have to take down the laughs. They're so big. Too big laugh really hurts you too sometimes. So we occasionally, to bridge a scene or to bridge a cut, we'll futz a little bit with the laugh, but not usually.
My guest is TV director James Burrows. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is TV director James Burrows. He was the resident director of Taxi, directed the pilots and many episodes of Cheers and Frasier, and has directed Will and Grace for the past 8 seasons. Now, you know, we were talking about Cheers, and of course, after Cheers, you worked on the spinoff Frasier, and you directed lots of episodes of that. You were there right at the start. Mm-hmm. Why was Frasier the character that you all decided to spin off?
I did not spin him off. David Angel, Peter Casey, and David Lee, who were the producers of Cheers from years 4 through 6 and then went on to do Wings, had talked to Kelsey about doing a spinoff. So they wrote the script, and they spun him off. They asked us if they could, and we said, sure. And they wrote a brilliant script. Their genius in that script was taking an actor who had this incredible ability, which Kelsey has, and taking Frasier, making him Sam Malone, because he had to be the center, and taking David Hyde Pierce as Niles and making him Frasier. So that was brilliant on their part. And the tone of that show was brilliant, too. The so much more upper crust than Cheers. Because other than Martin, the father, there was no other Sam Malones or Norms or Cliffs on that show. They were all upper crust, smart people. And they did a brilliant job. And I directed the pilot, which was huge. And I think I directed about 20, 25 episodes. And They did a great job, and they had a great actor in the lead and a great cast.
I want to play a short scene from the pilot, which you directed, of Frasier. And this is a scene from early in the episode. Niles and Frasier are at a coffee shop, and Niles is suggesting it's time to find a convalescent home for their father to live in.
We have a problem, and that's why I thought we should talk.
Is it Dad?
I'm afraid so. One of his old buddies from the police force called this morning. He went over to see him and found him on the bathroom floor.
Oh, my God.
No, it's okay. He's fine.
What, is his hip again?
Frasier, I don't think he can live alone anymore.
What can we do?
Well, I know this isn't going to be anyone's favorite solution, but I took the liberty of checking out a few convalescent homes for him.
Well, Niles, a home? He's still a young man.
Well, you certainly can't take care of him. You're just getting your new life together.
Absolutely. Well, besides, we were never simpatico.
Of course, I can't take care of him.
Oh, yes, yes, of course, of course. Why?
Because Dad doesn't get along with Maris.
Who does?
I thought you liked my Maris.
I do. I like her from a distance. You know, the way you like the sun. Maris is like the sun, except without the warmth.
Well, then, we're agreed about what to do with Dad. Golden Acres. We care so you don't have to.
It says that?
Well, it might as well.
All right, I'll make up the spare bedroom.
Oh, you're a good son, Frasier.
Oh, God, I am, aren't I?
Two Cafe Supremos? Anything to eat?
No, I seem to have lost my appetite.
I'll have a large piece of cheesecake.
It's a scene from the pilot of Frasier, directed by my guest James Burrows. And, you know, great scene, great series. One of the things that's really interesting to me about that scene and about, like, you know, the early Frasier is that Niles sounds completely different than he did later on. He is not talking with that, you know, kind of effete, clipped style of speech that he develops later in the series.
I did not notice that. I always thought that he was, there was no other word to describe Niles than effete for me, because he was a personification of Frasier, and a Frasier was certainly effete on Cheers. So I did not know that. Well, you know what? Niles was a minor character. If you talk to the boys, originally Niles only had one scene in the pilot. And he was an afterthought. They thought the strong relationship would be between father and son. And then because of David, that part expanded rapidly. And thank God, because it was a wonderful relationship.
No, you know, a lot of people thought that Niles and Frasier were really two gay men cast as brothers. Do you know what I mean? That the brothers was just a cover. This is a story about really two gay guys. Did you feel that way when you were directing it?
Oh, yeah. It's a husband and wife. Those two.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They are. They're a couple. They're a couple. And it's great. It's great. I think it really helped with Will and Grace, that relationship. I don't think they were gay. I never thought gay as much as a married couple. They talk like a married couple. A snobbish married couple. An effete married couple. So I totally agree with that.
Now, on Will and Grace, which you continue to direct, there really is a gay character, and it was among the first really popular gay regular characters on sitcoms and on broadcast. Were there issues about how broad to make the character, and you know how the character should be depicted?
Well, you know, the genius of that show is the script, is that Max and David wrote a script where there's a love affair between a woman and a man that can't be consummated. So the dialogue is brilliant in that script and very, very smart. So you have a gay man who you don't play gay, which gives you the liberty to play gay with the other character, with Jack. Jack can be incredibly outrageous because Will is Will is not. Will, you know, he gives you credibility, mainly among the gay community, because I think if Will wasn't on the show, we would get letters from the gay community about how Jack's portrayed, how that character's portrayed. But because of Will, it allows us to do that. So I always thought of the show as a really funny show that happens to have two gay characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
That was my goal in directing it. And I talked to Max and David, who wrote it, and I firmly believed that, you know, the pilot was through the roof when we ran it in front of an audience. They loved it. When we shot it, they loved it. And I went to the network and I said, please don't put us on don't put us after Seinfeld. We cannot survive there because people are not going to watch us. Please put us somewhere where we can kind of sneak into town. And people can, you know, find us eventually, because there's no reason to watch this show. And then I wanted, there's a kiss in the pilot between Will and Grace. And I wanted that in there because I felt that if we could convince the part of the country that doesn't appreciate gays or does not like gays or has some problems with gays, if we could convince that part of the country that maybe Will take the super drugs and get over his gayness and marry Grace, and if we let them think that they'll get together, that they maybe tune in to watch the show because they've heard how funny it was, and then once they're in there and see how funny it is, they're never going to leave. So we had a kiss in the first show, and we had a kiss at the last show at the end of the first year, just to do that. And then we started to get an audience, because once they started to tune in, they saw how funny the show was and how different it was and how inoffensive it was.
So are you really glad you've been able to have a career in TV?
I have been blessed. I did. In 1981, I tried a movie. If I had tried it in 91, the movie probably been more successful, because I would have had much more self-esteem than I had in 81. This is before Cheers. I didn't like the process because it took 2 years to get a result. I didn't like the hours. I'm not a guy who's meticulous with how the set looks and doing each scene 3 times so that you can then cut it. I'm a guy who likes to do it live in front of an audience, and I have been blessed to be able to work in this medium that I don't have to work anymore. I didn't have to do Will and Grace. I'm financially sound, and but I do it because I love it. I do it because Will and Grace makes me feel 20 years younger. I've been in this business about 35 years, so I just turned 25 last year. That's how old I am. And I love laughing. I love to hear the laughter. I've been lucky enough to be associated with some extraordinary shows, and shows that may not be as extraordinary, but were so wonderful, like News Radio, which I did the pilot of, and Third Rock with Johnny Lithgow. And I've had, you know, these wonderful shows, and it just, I'm going to go on next year. When Will and Grace is off the air, I'm going to try to find another show, because I have so much fun doing it.
Well, James Burroughs, thank you so much for talking with us. Congratulations on your award from the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival. And thank you so much for all the great programs that you've given us. Thank you.
And thank you for some questions I've never been asked before.
James Burroughs is being honored Saturday with a career tribute at the U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles remembers Ali Farkatoure, the guitarist and singer from Mali, died this week. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Guitarist and singer Ali Farka Touré of Mali died Tuesday of bone cancer. He was one of the best-known African performers in the world. He broke through to a Western audience when he collaborated with Rye Cooter in 1994 on the Grammy Award-winning album Talking Timbuktu. Touré won a second Grammy this year for his album In the Heart of the Moon. Music critic Milo Miles has a remembrance.
Ever since his first American albums came out in the late 1980s, Ali Farka Touré could not escape comparisons with classic blues players. He was ambivalent about it. He said that John Lee Hooker's influence on his playing was no different than that of the Tamashek people in North Mali, and in fact, that the blues grew out of African styles like his, not the other way around. The comparison was apt for more than musical reasons. Touré's work and life showed a dignity, gravity, and integrity that recalled the most noble of the old-time blues masters. Growing up without schooling in the desert country of Mali, his childhood fascination with music did not thrill his family of hardscrabble farmers. But Touré persisted. Although he worked as a taxi driver and a radio engineer in the 60s, he always gave concerts and even led bands. He could sing in 10 languages. The subtitle of his 1987 U.S. debut told the simple truth. 10 songs from the legendary singer from Mali. He had been a huge national star for decades and saw little reason to spend much time away from his country. Touré also resembled the blues greats in that he was adept at writing songs about issues like apartheid and all sorts of everyday matters like schooling, farm labor, fighting locusts, and in the following number, praising a sacred mountain, Hagana. Touré never made a weak record, though his earliest sides from the 70s have very wispy sound. His 1987 release, Ali Farka Touré, and a follow-up called The River, are his most potent, straightforward albums. And of course, his most famous release is Talking Timbuktu with Rye Cooter. With more musicians and fancier production than usual, Talking Timbuktu has much beauty and helped a wider audience hear Touré. It's a bit sweetened, though. There's some dabs of golf course in the desert. Talking Timbuktu sold well outside the regular world music audience and brought Touré his largest crowds and longest tours. He found international fame exhausting and distracting, however. In 1997, he declared he was retiring from music to go back to his hometown, Niafunke, and to his first love, farming. But just 2 years later, he made his masterpiece, recorded in and named after Niafunke. It was largely performed on traditional folk instruments, but it has the heft of all Touré's experiences in it, and the desert soul of Niafunke seems to creep into the music. Or perhaps the soul of Niafunke is Touré himself. He did become mayor in 2004. He operated a large rice farm, oversaw vast irrigation projects, sponsored and helped record young musicians, and supported his many children. He knows all about that. Ali Touré was given the name Farka because he was his parents' 10th child and the first to survive to adulthood. Farka means donkey, and it properly honors the man. Tough, determined, hardworking, good to have around.
Music critic Milo Miles. Ali Farka Touré died Tuesday of bone cancer. He was in his mid-60s. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. And from Jane and Gerald Catcher for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Philip Baker Hall. He's best known for his work in the Paul Thomas Anderson films Hard Eight, Boogie Nights, and Magnolia. On Seinfeld, he played a hard-boiled library cop on the trail of overdue books. He co-stars in the new Fox TV sitcom The Loop. Join us for the next Fresh Air.